podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast in association with Charles Tirrett, who are supporting the podcast Over the Ashes series. Known for their stylish shirts, it's worth checking out their knitwear range, including crewnecks, their V-necks, or even their zipnecks. Available in a variety of colours and perfect for wearing to the office or even when, and this is more relevant than it was in previous weeks, when you're working from home. During this period, we'll be offering a discount for our listeners. If you use the code WISDEN20 at checkout, as a code suggests, you'll get 20% off your order. That's code WISDEN20. Australia are 1-0 up in the 2021-22 Ashes series after a dominant 9-wicket win at the Gabba. I'm Yaz Ron, and to absorb those 3.5 days with me is the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the features editor of Wisden.com, Tahar Hashim. Mark Butcher will be joining us over the phone later in the show. Lizzie Ammon asks, why do we do this? That's a question that I was asking myself a lot, but especially this morning as England lost 8 wickets in no time. Joe, I asked you how you were feeling about the series before the start of the first test. How are you feeling one test in?
Tired and a bit angry, which is...
Angry?
A bit. I guess it's a kind of familiar feeling for these Ashes tours, but it does seem to have come around a bit quicker than I was hoping. I mean, it couldn't have been any quicker with the first ball. And then things kind of went downhill from there, then picked up a little bit just to give you that glimmer of hope, although not really much of a hope at that stage. And then obviously collapsed like a pack of cards on day four. The set of dismissals on day four was dispiritingly limp, really, after the fight that Root and Malan had shown, and that sense that England are probably going to lose the game, but they might be able to kind of go into Adelaide with their head held high, having pushed Australia, shown that there was another side in this series and they weren't just going to be a walkover. Day four didn't give that impression at all. Day four was much like day one and day two. And over the course of the test match, England were thoroughly outplayed with bat, ball, and also in the field. Australia's fielding was excellent. England's was pretty poor. So I'm sure you're going to ask at some point in this podcast, reasons to be cheerful. There aren't that many to take from what we've just seen over the last 4 days, unfortunately.
Tahar, days one, two and four couldn't really have gone that much worse for England. It did feel a lot like previous Ashes series gone by, and to the extent to which it felt like it was the fourth test and England were 3-0 down on day two.
Yeah, I mean, it's... the thing is, like, it's like... are we surprised? I mean, England have kind of they've had a pretty bad year. So in that way, you know, there's not that much of a surprise. But then there's this thing where, you know, you're kind of building up to the Ashes, and suddenly everything's kind of like, oh, England aren't too bad. They've got Ben Stokes. Oh, the weather might suit them. All that kind of thing. And so you're kind of in your head, you're thinking, oh, this could be quite close. It could be quite close. And then in just one ball, it goes, no, it's not happening. And that kind of just, it was almost too quick. Whereas last time around at the Gabba, that first day was quite a positive one for England, wasn't it? With Vince getting runs, with Stoneman getting runs. This time it was just like, oh, right, okay, we're in this deep. It's not going to go well. Day three was hopeful for England fans. Certainly,
day three was really good.
Really good. Really good. I saw you after day three.
You were buzzing.
You were deprived of sleep.
You were highly caffeinated and buzzing for it. And it was nice to see. But it also gave me sort of, for some people, it was sort of the hope was, oh, this could be like 2010-11. But just seeing Root and Milan get runs, it was kind of like, this could also be, I saw this partnership happen last time around 4 years ago, and there was kind of hope there, but...
Is that the Adelaide test match you were saying?
I think that's the one. But
in terms of misplaced optimism, there was a graphic they flashed up yesterday, which kind of really hammered it home, which we all know the stats, but they're worth repeating that Root has scored almost 1,000 more runs, or is it more than 1,000? More than 1,000 more runs than any other England player.
Yeah. He looked good though.
Dom Sibley is England's third highest scorer this year. He got dropped, what, three tests ago, and is averaging sub 20. It's kind of laughable that we think that England can compete in any way whatsoever. Their bowlers who I thought were really unlucky across this test match, can bowl as well as they want. But if England aren't going to score any runs, then they're not going to win any test matches. And it really, when Root trudged off after getting, what, 88 was it he got yesterday? And I don't know which of the Aussie commentators were, there are so many of them, said, 88, well battered, but that's not enough. And, you know, it should be enough.
Yeah,
yeah. It should be enough. You don't want to get out for 88 every time, but yeah, it's only not enough because the rest of the batting unit is kind of frankly pathetic. As I say, to have Sibley as our third top scorer for the year when he's not in the side and he's averaging 19, to have Burns as our second highest run scorer, and hasn't he broken the record for most ducks in a...
For an opener. So no opener, yeah. So he's got six ducks in 2021. No opener has ever done that before.
And this is our second highest score this year. Second highest score after Root.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can dress it up all we want, but with those stats, the upscaling required of England's batting is enormous for them to stand any chance.
Yeah, there isn't that much debate about whether or not this group of batters England have taken to Australia the best England have got available. What do you think has happened? Because they've done all right. Individuals there have won England Test matches against decent opposition fairly recently. Is it partly, I mean, Butler and Stokes haven't played that many Test matches in 2021. They've not got that much cricket behind them. A player like Pope, I guess, hasn't developed in the way you'd expect him to. Burns has always kind of been this weird player who either does actually very, very well and scores hundreds kind of when you least expect him to, but then goes through quite long, lean patches. But it's widely accepted he's probably England's best opener. Yeah, well, why do you think it's been this bad in 2021?
Well, I did just want to say there's something sort of oddly comedic about for 2 years hearing we need to score big first inning runs in Australia, big first inning runs, and then all out 147 first day. You're right, this is probably the best group of England batters available. I wouldn't say that. If you look through that lineup, who has really won England matches recently, though? Rory Burns, when he's got hundreds, England really haven't won games. you know, Hamida's still just into the side. Milan's just come back into the side and, you know, is one of the few positives from this test. Root is the main guy. Really is. Stokes, like you say, hasn't played much this year. So there's that obvious rustiness. And Pope, it's just... It's a weird one, isn't it? Because it was just like, it just felt so nailed on when he first came into that side. And it's just like, it's just not clicked for him.
And there are still glimpses there. It's not the scale. When Crawley had his kind of collapse, he just didn't look like he was going to get a run. Whereas Pope batted quite nicely.
He'll get to 20, 30.
And that's the frustration. I still have a lot of hope for Pope. I think he will come good. But I have been saying that for a little while. But you know, it's easy to forget how young he is. In terms of England's batting failures in this test, obviously people will point to their lack of preparation, and that is undeniably an issue. But it is an issue for just test cricket in general. It's an issue for the game, and there's no point whinging about it, really. We don't like it. We wish it was different, but it's not going to change. New Zealand had almost no preparation when they arrived in England before turning them over this summer. India, the same, had very little... acclimatization period before, not turning over England, still to be decided, but you know, being up in the series, beating them in their London venues. So these problems are tricky, but they're not insurmountable. Apart from for England, they seem to be.
Joe, I want to go back to that first ball again. Just how special was that as a moment of theatre? All the build up and then to have that first ball of the Ashes series was, I thought that was amazing, even though from an England perspective I hated it. But I thought just as a moment that people will stick in them, that moment will stick in their memories for a very long time. That was brilliant.
Oh, absolutely. It will go down in Ashes folklore alongside, or English Ashes folklore alongside, NASA choosing to field at the Gabba and Harmison's first ball wide. And it was just as dramatic as, it was more dramatic than Harmison, really. Because Harmison, that's become a big thing, but in the context of the game, it didn't really matter, really. With Burns, that really did matter because all we were talking about was you need to get through that new ball, give Root a little bit of protection. And within one ball, he's gone. A couple of overs later, Milan's gone. And the game already feels like it's almost not out of England's reach, because obviously it's not. There is time to come back. But it just felt so kind of grimly inevitable as soon as it happened. But, and just the image of the whole thing. I mean, I've gone through some of the photos of Burns' dismissal. Well, he is in an extraordinary position as the stumps are impacted. And, you know, the emotion of it all starts kind of veins popping on his head. It was extraordinary.
What makes that ball so surreal is the fact that it's obviously quick, but even sort of the ball's like halfway down and you can see where Burns is and you're like, oh, he's like, he's missing this. And if he's missing this, he's gone. Like, that's what made it so just incredible, because it was so like, you didn't need to watch the ball hit the stumps. You knew sort of just a few seconds, milliseconds earlier that, oh, he's gone here.
Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed some of the Australian coverage of it. There's the video from Triple M Radio where the commentator basically completely loses any control over what he's saying and then ends up saying, off you trot, Burns, pointing at Burns, kind of ushering him away. And Izzy Westbury, who's I guess, the only English commentator in that team, kind of is trying to escape the room as the wicket falls, then as the wicket falls, Aaron Finch walks into the room. So you got this World Cup winning Australia captain strolling into the room. Australia take a wicket with the first ball of the series. Joe, this might be looking into things a little bit too much, but how much do you think the history of English Ashes failures in Australia hangs over the players? Because even the toss, you know, there was something in the pitch. It was clear. The conditions were reasonably overcast. England are a much stronger bowling attack than they are a batting unit at the moment. Australia are a weaker batting unit than they are a bowling attack at the moment. How much do you think Nassar's will have a bowl in 2002 impacted things? And also, how much do you think just the occasion kind of potentially gets the England players, and knowing the history of English failing in Australia?
I think it can't not have an impact. Just look at the impact it has on us as writers, broadcasters, as the fans as well. I can't imagine that doesn't seep through to the players. And we know players have talked about it before. When they won in 10-11, so much of the preamble to that series was putting all that stuff out of their mind and focusing just on the challenge ahead, not letting history impact you. So we know it's played its part in the past. And I think the toss is a little bit of a red herring, given how dominant Australia were in this match. I don't think we can go, well, you know, Root probably does regret batting now, but I don't think if he'd fielded based on the quality of the two teams, England would have won the match. But you're right, I think if Root was out there in the middle, looked down and saw that pitch, looked above and saw those overhead conditions, and he was in South Africa or New Zealand or England or potentially elsewhere in Australia, not at the Gabba, then I think he'd had a bowl. And yeah, and that is absolutely wrapped up in the kind of folklore of the whole thing and these critical moments in Ashes history playing on your minds. And in some ways it was a brave call, because as we discussed previously on the show, even if Australia had racked up kind of 400, you know, England might have responded in kind, but when you've been skittled for such a low score in the first innings, it's very, very hard to come back from. The game was basically gone. We could look into the intricacies and like, how can they get out of this? But the game was basically gone.
I thought one possible factor for Root in wanting to bat first is actually the last two times he chose to bowl first were Lords and Oval against India, and England properly folded in both fourth innings. And I wonder if that played into his mind at all. The last two times he decided to do that, England have lost. So I guess that's fair enough. I caught up with Butch earlier to get his thoughts on what happened. Morning, Butch. We're talking about 6 hours after England were consigned to a 9-wicket defeat in the opening test. Going right back to the start of the test match, what did you make of the selection, the call to leave out both, not only Jimmy Anderson, but Stuart Broad as well?
The reports we heard early were that Anderson had a slight tweak in the calf, and so that was more to do with fitness than anything else. And the Broad one came as a little bit of a surprise, but then when you looked at the way that the team lined up, you kind of understood it. I was less annoyed about that. I mean, obviously people are going to say, well, you know, Broad had Warner on toast. England didn't bowl around the wicket at Warner. There's a 1300 test wicket sort of sat on the bench, all that type of thing. But if you're not on the ground and you don't know how they've trained or what's going on, then it's difficult to make that call. So I was kind of okay with that, because I still think that Wokes and Robinson will be England's most effective bowlers on the trip. So I kind of, I didn't have a problem with that. And I understood the need to have this, the extra pace of Wood in the team. So I, on that side of it, I wasn't bothered. The thing that bothered me most was the kind of this idea. And I've even heard some people sort of going all the way back to NASA in 2002 and sort of blaming NASA's decision to bat, to bowl first there for a reason as to why England would have decided to bat first on day one. You know, if it's easier to look back that far, if you're saying that the team looked back that far and took their information from a completely different set of circumstances back in 2002, as opposed to opening their bedroom window and going, Jesus Christ, it looked dark and humid and it's been raining for a month and that influenced their decision, then you and they are insane. It just looked like a bowling day all day long. And I'm not saying that that's the reason they lost the test match. But what I am saying is it did not make it difficult. It makes it so, so tough for yourself. On the pod that we did in the lead up to the test match, so if it's going to looks like it's going to be a shortened game, if it looks like rain is going to have an effect in it, then you'd probably bowl first. Because the way to win a match when time gets taken out bit is that you bowl the opposition out cheaply in the first innings. You make runs when it's easier to bat. And at the Gabba, it's always easier to bat day two, day three. And then you bowl them out again when it becomes tough again on the other side. And that's pretty much what Australia did. And England handed Australia that advantage through a, I don't know. I mean, they tend to get a lot of these big calls wrong, England, at the moment. And it makes life doubly difficult for a team that is, well, struggling. Mercurial would be the polite way of putting it.
On last week's pod, you talked about the importance of being bold when you're playing Australia in Australia. And I'm kind of thinking, if I'm Australia and I see the England team sheet on day one of an Ashes series and I see Stuart Broad's not playing, Jack Leach is playing, I'm probably liking that from an Australian perspective, especially given how well Broad bowled in 2019, how well he bowled to David Warner, how well he bowled to left-handers in general. What do you make of the, I guess, treatment of the man who came in for him, Jack Leach? Not played a single test match outside Asia since Chris Silverwood's first test match in charge all the way back in 2019. He's not. He obviously went. He went for a lot. He went at eights and nines for a lot of the Australia first innings. But what do you make of the decision to trust him now of all times?
Well, I would encourage people to go back through the pods through the summer to get an idea of what I think about the way Jack Leach has been handled and Jack Leach's role in the England team and Jack Leach's likely role in the Ashes. And how England have completely and utterly stuffed that up. They've messed him up and they've messed their own chances of winning an Ashes series up in doing so. Go back to the New Zealand series. Jack Leach just come off his best ever performance for England in India, albeit very different conditions, the ball turning, you know, spinners ruling the roost in India. But he's confident. He feels like he's a member of the team. He's contributing. And is in the best sort of physical and mental shape that he could possibly be as an England player. Come the summer, England decide that if Ben Stokes isn't going to be available or Chris Wokes isn't going to be available, there's no place in the team for Jack Leach. So Jack Leach doesn't play in two friendly matches, basically, against New Zealand. He should have played. He then doesn't get a gig in any of the test matches against India. Now, I argued from very, very long time back that England are going to need to know if Jack Leach can hold first innings and then perhaps do what he's most likely, most renowned for, which is take wickets when the pitch starts to turn at the end. They're going to need to know that because in Australia, you have to have a spin bowler who can bowl maybe a third or slightly less than a third of your overs when it's roasting hot and the Kookaburra ball has gone flat and the pitch is flat. You have to have somebody. That's how Australia have been successful. That's what Nathan Lyon has been able to do for them as he goes past 400 test match wickets as a finger spinner. Stunning performance. You have to have that. There's just no way around it. And so knowing that that was the case, Jack Leach, they had to find out if Jack Leach could do that. And if that meant playing only a four-man bowling attack during the summer against New Zealand, three quicks and a spinner, to see if Leach could do that or not, then so be it. Do that because that's preparation for what comes later. They decided they weren't going to do that. He didn't play. So he then has no test match cricket whatsoever from his best ever performance up until the toughest series that he's ever going to play in. And then gets thrown in the first test against a team full of left-handers on a pitch with no spin in Brisbane. And guess what? They decide they're going to come charging at him like the Light Brigade and just smash him out of the park. Now they've got a massive, massive problem. And it's a problem all of their own making.
What do you think happened there? Because we've been critical of England putting too much emphasis on everything being Ashes preparation. They'd have series against number one and number two teams in the world, and they'd openly say, it's all about the Ashes, it's all about the Ashes, we're all building towards the Ashes. And here we are, going into the first test of that Ashes series, them doing something they haven't seemingly prepared for. What do you think happened there?
Well, the thing is, it's all very well saying you're preparing for the Ashes, but there are the actions that are meant, or that are required. You know, and the actions are playing, if you're trying to play an 11, a balanced 11, to win test matches. And that actually isn't preparation for the Ashes. That's just playing good test cricket. Now, England sort of decided they were going to do without a spinner full stop for large portions of the summer. And, you know, you could look back at some of the conditions that we played on in England and say that was perfectly reasonable thing to do. But it's not. It just isn't. The greatest Australian team, the best Australian team that I played against, come hell or high water, it didn't matter if the game was a two-day game or a four-day game. And admittedly, the spin bowler we're talking about was Shane Warne, went in with four bowlers, right? They were their four best bowlers and they all had very specific roles. And those roles would come into play throughout the course of the five-day test match. Which is why Australia in this test match were able to name their team 3 days out from the start of the game. It didn't make any difference to them whether it was going to be a shortened game, whether the pitch was going to be very, very green or whether the pitch was going to be brown and flat. It made no odds because they had the attack that was going to be able to cope with whatever conditions came up over the course of the 5 days. England do it a different way. They leave it to the last minute to pick the team. They then try and guess what the pitch is going to do on day one and day two, and then forget about what's going to happen later on down the line. You know, and this sounds like a very, very harsh critique, but it's kind of, you know, I've watched them do it. I've watched them do it since that the Wanderers test match in South Africa, where they decided to go in. Don Best had taken wickets in the sort of series winning matches in South Africa, and they decided to go in with five quicks in the test match of the Wanderers. They won the game. But I didn't agree with it then, and I certainly don't agree with what it's now led to. It's led to a position where England's spin bowler, their number one spin bowler, has no bowling under his belt in Test match cricket. They have very little confidence in him. He has very little confidence in himself. And now they're going to be thinking very seriously about playing five quicks again in the day-night Test match.
England aren't very good at batting, Butch. In 2021, they've been bowled out for under 200, 10 times out of 22 completed innings. And if you go through the numbers of all the batters who played for England in 2021, only Root and Milan averaged more than 30. Burns is the only player to score 100 other than Joe Root. Most of the batters average somewhere between 19 and 28. On Rory Burns, it was an amazing moment. Mitchell start bowling him with the first ball of the series. But he's had troubles against quick left arm pacers who swing the ball a lot. I mean, no one enjoys that particularly, but he's got a string of very low scores against Shaheen and now Stark nearly got him out of the two ducks here. How do you feel about Burns going into the rest of the series?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've always had an enormous amount of admiration and respect for Rory Burns, because anybody that can play the way that he does or has the sort of technique that he does, and who is largely very successful in doing so, first class level, yes, and has been okay as a test match player, and hasn't allowed the sort of the you know, the criticism or whatever of his technique sort of change what he does, and he hasn't been shifted off that course, has got to have some sort of mental strength. However, I do marvel and wince at times at how he manages to score any runs at all playing the way that he does. I mean, it is quite extraordinary. And one of the things that left arm pace does when that front foot goes as far across to the offside as it does with him, it kind of just leaves you exposed to everything. The angle of left arm makes it far, far worse than it does to the right arm coming over the wicket, because a lot of the balls from right arm over the wicket are kind of going to go past the off stump, but the left armer can actually hit middle and leg, all that kind of stuff, with the ball pitching in line. So you've got real big problems there. The other thing is that the pace that Stark is bowling, the pace Shaheen bowls, the speed of the relative speed of the pitches in Australia versus the pitches in England is that Rory Burns is very, very adept at home in pulling that right leg back out of the way and allowing the bat the path to come through and access the ball. When the pitches are quicker, you don't have time to get the pad out of the way anymore. It just kind of, you know, it's just, you're not fast enough to sort of drag that foot back out of line and get the bat down, which makes life very, very difficult indeed. First innings dismissal was as much nerves as anything, because I don't think I've ever seen his front foot go that far across. You know, it always goes, but never. You know, it was two sets of stumps across outside off stump. And so, you know, horrendous start to the trip for him. I think he dropped a catch as well, didn't he? So he's feeling massively under the pump at the moment. But, you know, Hazelwood in the second innings ran up and tried to hit leg stump, didn't he? Bowling over the wicket as a right armer. So Australia are onto him, and they're going to make it very, very difficult. So something is probably going to have to change in terms of his technique. He's going to have to become a little bit more orthodox, perhaps. Or he's going to find himself out of the team, and you know, Zach Crawley or even Johnny Bairstow might find themselves at the top of the order for England sooner rather than later.
I wanted to ask you about another Surrey man, Ollie Pope. When he scored those runs in New Zealand and South Africa in 2019-20, averaging around about 50 over the course of that winter, it looked like all the promise that he'd shown in the county game was bearing fruit in the test game. It looked like he was going to make that step up. It's not really happened for him since. This year, he averages about 23. And I think even watching him at the Oval in the county championship this year, there's something frenetic about the way he is at the crease. He seemed rushed. And even more so when he's playing test cricket now. And I know he got that 80 against India in the summer, but there's been a lot of low scores for Pope in 2021. What do you think's happened there? I thought he was really frenetic in both innings in this test match. And I think he gets almost too low when the ball for balls that bounce more than he expects. So the top edge is always quite a likely occurrence.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, again, now here's a lad that is unbelievably talented. There's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of nerves around in Ashes cricket. Don't underestimate how hyped up and how much the nerves are jangling around in your first Ashes trip away from home, Brisbane Test. All of the folklore around the Gabatoir and all that kind of stuff, it can get to you. And again, I agree. I think he just looks like his pants are on fire a bit at the moment. And there needs to be some sort of calming. I don't think that there's anything particularly wrong with the way that he plays. I just think he's trying to get to 30 before he's got to two. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's something really sort of really agitated about the way he's playing at the moment. Hopefully that'll be match out of the way, bit of nerves. He's kind of been in the country a little bit, had a taste of it, and we'll be able to calm himself down and be a little bit more assured at the crease. But he's somebody else. His reputation goes before him, and people are kind of very, very happy to look at that and say, well, it's county cricket. He plays at the Oval. He's going to score a lot of runs. He's a fantastic young player. That doesn't mean that he gets a rope that is so long that he can continually fail and not feel the consequences of that. But I would be very happy to allow somebody as talented as Ollie Pope as much rope as you could possibly give him. The problem is you're giving him a lot of rope in a batting lineup that isn't scoring any runs. So it looks doubly bad. So there are problems, huge issues with the order. Good, positives in the order is I thought Hamid looked terrific. I was asked in a podcast a couple of weeks back, probably wasn't the last one, but the one before that, if I was concerned about his technique against the bouncing ball and, the pace of Aussie pitches. I gave a one-word answer, no, and I'm happy to stand by that. I thought he looked fabulous. His footwork was sensational. One of the few players to sort of get a really big stride forward into the likes of Cummings and Hazelwood. Also played the high ball pretty well too. He's just got to get find a watch some videotape of videotape. How old am I? Just get a little bit of a look at the way that Marnus Labuschagne played in the first innings and the way that he um, negotiated where his off stump was and you know, allowed plenty of balls to go over the top of the stump. Both he and Joe Root actually caught out pushing at balls on in the channel outside of off stump off the front foot and nicking deliveries that they could very safely have left. And balls that wouldn't have cost them their wicket on less bouncy tracks at home. So, you know, that's a learning thing for him. And it's also, you know, I always think about this in terms of winter trips. The Aussies, even though that it appears that they haven't played a massive amount of cricket either in the lead up at the World T20 and all the rest of it, the build up to your season, you know, build up for them is August, September, whatever, August, September, they sort of have their pre-season and they're beginning that, you know, their workload is on the rise. Where, of course, at the end of our season, everything's kind of winding down. You kind of feel like you've got to the peak of the mountain there and you're winding down and then you've got to come back up again. And it is much easier for the home team as it is for us when teams come to us cold at the back end of their summers. You know, their preparation is a little bit behind. And of course, England had no time whatsoever in terms of practice matches. You got COVID, you got the weather kind of disrupted everything in the lead up. And they were very, very undercooked in both departments, batting and bowling. So I do have a certain amount of sympathy for them. I do think that they make life very difficult for themselves unnecessarily. And I do think that they're lacking a bit of quality. That's, you know, particularly in the batting department. Mm.
Another positive was Milan. Milan batted pretty well to get that 80 odd. And I kind of wondered with Hamid looking as good as he did. And I know I don't want to get too excited by scores of 25 and 27. But that's probably the most comfortable I've seen him in Test cricket against pace. And Milan, someone who's not played that much Test cricket recently. I mean, Ed Smith famously said his game suited overseas pitches more than it did home pitches. I was kind of wondering, and maybe I'm asking this too early in the series, but how good a parameter are English county pitches for batter's ability to face good pace bowling? Because Hamid, you know, is well documented, averages 29 against pace bowling over the course of his entire first class career. That's in Division 1, that's in Division 2. And then up against Hazelwood, Stark and Cummins looks all right. You know, what's going on?
using the wrong jargon around visual aids and visual training aids aside, but being older has its own advantages in that I can remember in the early to mid 90s where county pitches were very much suited to the medium pace wobbler, you know, sideways movement, low bounce, all that type of stuff, made trying to understand who the better players were around very, very difficult. And we have a very similar situation to that now. In fact, I'd go as far as to say they're probably worse at the moment than they were even back then, which does make it very, very, very difficult to work out who the better players are, which is why you kind of, you know, which is why I remember the first time I saw Hamid play and in England under-19s against Australia, funny enough. And I saw him play and I just thought, this kid's got it. You know, just technique-wise, he just looked streets ahead of all the other kids in that team. And Milan, you know, Milan, I thought that was harsh when Ed Smith said that about Milan. He obviously knows how to make runs in England because he's done so over many years as a proper top county pro. And that's part of what I like about having him in there at number three. Again, I've been on record saying it, that he brings a sort of, you know, he brings a sort of know-how and a cussedness of somebody that has been around for a long time and understands his game. And there are no frills. He's not out there trying to sort of impress people that he can play. He knows he can play. He's got numbers behind him. He made big runs last year for Yorkshire. And, you know, should be in the prime of his career. So, you know, he's quite a sort of a sober presence in that top order. And somebody that, you know, Joe Root gets an ally there to be able to pile some big runs on the board that will give England a foothold in the series. So, yeah, that's a big tick.
And finally, you said, I think you said it'd be 3-1 last week. Are you still sticking by that prediction?
It could be worse. The thing is with these guys, you still feel that they got a win in them somewhere, don't you? I mean, that's that they've proven that over the years. They're just, they're not good enough to win the series. I can't. There's no way that they will be consistent enough. I mean, but put it this way: you watch the way that Australia performed in the Test match, and they had their little periods where they, you know, they lost a couple of wickets, but they were able to rebuild, or they didn't bowl so well at the back end of the third evening, but then came roaring back in the beginning of the day four. My suspicion always was that, you know, that in Australia that final session is really tough on fielding teams, and it, you know, the ball gets tired and pitch gets flat and it's roasting hot and whatever. But then what happens the next morning is that they, you know, come back refreshed, and it can be a real struggle for a couple of batters who were in flowing on the previous evening to then get going again the next day. In fact, I can point to 2002-03 when Marcus Trescothick and I both walked off 50 not out, I think, at the end of day two or day three, probably day two, I think, of that infamous Test match. And then came back the next day and kind of, you know, couldn't lay a bat on it the next morning, you know. So it is, you know, that didn't surprise me what happened in the wee small hours of this morning today.
Cricket 22 is out now on PlayStation 4 and 5, Xbox One and Series XS and PC, the latest from Big Ant, the biggest name in cricket simulations. Cricket 22 gives you unprecedented depth with new controls, gameplay, a narrative-driven career mode, a new commentary team, and all new team and competition licenses. Play along with this year's Ashes competition, take part in the 100, or move through the ranks to represent your nation at the highest level. Cricket 22 has it all, and remember, it is out right now. We've touched on it already, and Butch talked about England's batting as well. Tal, were there some positives there despite the two collapses? I thought Milan looked pretty good second innings. Hamid, I thought, looked very solid up until both of his dismissals, but yeah, he got 27 and 25, and I thought Butler looked pretty good in both innings. What do you think?
Yeah, I thought, Hamid did look nice. I thought he left pretty well in that first morning. And yeah, I mean, I'm so wrapped up in the story that I just don't want to see him fail. And it was a positive start, but still, it's just a pair of 20s. And I guess that if you're being critical, you think he's got the two starts there. Oh, if he just got a 50 just to get his series going, that would have been good. Milan, like we said, I mean, he was one of England's best batters 4 years ago, and that's been, I guess, somewhat of a success story so far. It was kind of the right call to bring him back in the summer, and he looks the part. He had a bit of luck, but I guess you need a bit of luck as well, and he got something there. The one guy that's kind of interested me going into the series was Joss Butler, and the fact that, you know, Test cricket is, you know, he's never really nailed it. He's had his moments. He was having his moments earlier the last summer, building into this year, and then he was rested again, and then just had such a disjointed year that it felt like, oh, he was just starting to click, and then he really struggled. And when he came back in the summer against India, and it's always been kind of weird watching him, because he himself has talked about, well, I can't really play that white ball mode in red ball cricket. He's, you know, I have to play the situation, is what he says, and you've got to have a solid defence. But coming to the series, he talked about wanting to play with a sense of freedom, and he'd come off the T20 World Cup as well. And so it was quite interesting watching him in this Test match, because there was a level of counter-attack in that first innings. And there was also that yesterday as well for a bit.
When we were allowed to watch it.
Yes, that's right, yeah. There was one moment where we were on the sort of the third man camera, and he either played the greatest shot I've ever seen, or he played a missed. And I later found out that he had played a missed.
We should give, for people who didn't stay up last night, yeah, let's give a bit of context on what happened with the...
Yeah, so for half an hour, Fox, who were providing the world feed, the feed went down. So it was literally impossible to watch the cricket for about half an hour anywhere in the world unless you were in the ground. And it's linked with the technological failures that meant that there was no checking of the front foot, no ball from the TV umpire, and also there was no snicker in the Test match. And I think Dan Brettig reported in The Age in Australia that because of Brisbane's strict quarantine rules, Fox's production team was less than a third of its normal size. So they couldn't, when things went wrong and things weren't quite working well a few times in the Test match, they didn't have the personnel there to fix things quickly. So there was a power outage basically. So you had this ridiculous situation where the feed you were getting was just a solitary camera that BT were using for their pitch side interviews from Third Man, with Matt Smith, Alistair Cook, and Steve Holmes in the BT studio providing the commentary on it. Yeah. And Alistair Cook
filibustering for their lives. Yeah. Yeah.
Alistair Cook quite early on admitting that this isn't really where he comes into his own.
Oddly enough, that was probably the most England's best passage of players.
Yes, it was.
They did well, didn't they?
They did really well. They looked really good. Obviously, you couldn't tell where the ball was, but they looked. They were getting a nice. I think Harbison said they're getting in nice positions. And I was like, yeah, they are actually. Yeah, I could kind of see that.
Yeah. Quite an interesting dynamic developing there with BT, who obviously decided to take Fox's commentary but hate it. So they can't help but kind of slag it off.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure really. I can understand where they're coming from. I do find some of the Aussie commentary quite frustrating, but not sure it's the best way to sell your product, particularly when presumably BT could have sent their own commentary team out there if they'd wanted to splash out a bit. So they've taken Fox and are now openly saying they think it's rubbish, which is a bit of an odd way to present your Ashes coverage.
It was a bit odd. Maybe it's because I was watching the last 4 days alone and I'm sleep deprived, but I actually kind of, it grew on me, the Fox coverage. I thought it was all right by the end
of
it.
You need to get back into society for the next few days, Yaz, and see some more people, enjoy life again.
This is basically the first conversation I've had in 4 days. I promise we will talk about Australia in a bit more depth and the positives of Australia in a bit. But I just wanted to dwell on that Milan root partnership for a bit, because that was the only pretty much that was the best bit of the test, wasn't it? I thought those two showed that in Australia, when the pitch is flat, the Kookaburra ball gets old, this Australia attack, like every attack ever, it's difficult to get wickets. I thought it was interesting that Hazelwood seemed to actually be fit. He just didn't bowl with the old ball. Stark was very loose. Lyon wasn't quite as threatening as he was on day four. I mean, even Cummins wasn't quite his threatening self. So, Joe, you can see how England, if one or two players get into form, can trouble Australia.
That as you wrote when you predicted the Great Escape was on.
I didn't predict it. I just said
that's what the headline said, didn't it?
Yeah. It was on. Doesn't mean it's going to happen.
On question mark? Sure. That there was a template there. There was a glimpse of how England could do well in Australia. Crucially, Root didn't come to the crease until the 21st over, I think. Hamid, obviously, he only got 20-odd, but did stick around, did blunt the new ball, which makes it so much easier for Root. And obviously, we didn't lose a wicket to the very first delivery of the innings, which is also helpful. So there is... I guess a glimmer of hope. But the problem is, how many of England's players have done it consistently? I mean, we're just coming back to the point made earlier, but Stokes is obviously one who can play in that manner in that Milan, I suppose, did. Root was so fluent, he's just playing on another level. You can't say Root's doing that, so that gives England optimism, because he's just on a different plane. But Milan playing that way, I think there is a lot to be learned there, and he started to leave quite well after playing a poor shot in the first innings. Let's be honest, he did have a little bit of luck as well. Although, when you compare it with David Warner's luck in the first innings, I suppose that may be balanced out, perhaps. So there is something there. And I don't think, even though I think England are going to lose comprehensively, I think there will still be moments, by the very nature of the pitches, that England do have good days and do score a lot of runs. But the question is, can they string them together? And we had one good day, and the next morning it was all basically made broadly irrelevant. It was frustrating as well that Root didn't get that 100. Not that the 12 runs would have made any difference in terms of the match, of course, but just to get that kind of monkey off his back, that feeling of having scored that Ashes 100, that people can stop talking about that thing. But then there are obviously issues in that England batting lineup that is the worst possible start for Rory Burns, isn't it? I mean, obviously the first ball was literally the worst possible spot, but that test match could have been out for a duck in the second innings. That drop of Warner was at a really key moment after England had bowled brilliantly on that first morning on day two. Really bad drop. Doesn't get any runs in the second innings. And now there is going to be immediately pressure on his place. He's probably two more failures away from being dropped, and you don't want to start an Ashes series in that kind of vein, because it's very, very hard to pull it back, especially when you're walking out to face Hazelwood and Cummins.
Well, one thing on England not making the most of good batting conditions since the start of the 2015 Ashes, Australia have scored 850 plus individual scores in that time. England have only had one. Cook's 244 at Melbourne. Taha Cummins picked up his first Ashes fifer in the first innings, his first test as captain. Him and Hazelwood are just so good. I mean, we've been critical of England's batting lineup, but when the ball's doing stuff, those guys look as lethal as anyone on the planet at the moment.
Yeah, and they're so good that it's kind of like, it's not particularly exciting to watch them because they are just so, there's not a great deal of drama to watching those two guys because you know exactly what they're going to do. They're just going to play bowl those same areas, be really subtle with their changes where the batter feels it. Maybe we don't particularly see it, but the batters can tell, oh, they're kind of doing something different here. And their sort of boringness is what makes them so exceptional. Whereas Stark is kind of, it's quite exciting because he's can be a bit all over the place, but then bowl like some sort of incredible Yorker or something like that, basically. But yeah, those two were, you know, exceptional again. Those two are the ones I imagine the England batters worry about the most, you know. But I think that the kind of interesting thing I found about this Australia attack in this test is just what a kind of Cameron Green's importance now. He's probably more important now than he was when he first came in against India, just because of the fact that these Australian bowlers are coming in very undercooked. You know, they've just been playing at a T20 World Cup where they're just bowling four overs. And so you don't want to put too much of a burden on them. England not batting for a long period helps with that too. But then you saw Green's importance in that second innings where he's, you know, no, he comes in and he was able to tie up an end, which is exactly what you want from him as your fourth seamer. And I think his story is an interesting one. And the one that, you know, he came into Australian cricket and, you know, state cricket as a out and out quick. He was, you know, 17 years old. He kind of got a fifer on his first class debut. And he's only kind of come in as a batter and like just tore it up in the last couple of years. But he's had back problems and, you know, stress fractures. And
you're saying he's remodeled his action as well.
Basically, he had a back stress fracture 2 years ago. The bowling coach that came in at Western Australia, Matt Mason, took a look at him and said, we need to sort this out because you're just going to keep breaking down, basically. Mm-hmm. And Green himself, I think, recognised that he needed to sort himself out because he was kept on getting these injuries. And leading into the series, Mason... I interviewed Mason and he told me how, you know, obviously last summer it was kind of, he got called in and Mason himself was kind of like, oh, he's still not ready, you know, and you could see it against India. He didn't take a wicket. His overs were controlled. They were managing his workload and slowly he's been building up and building up and now he can bowl a few more overs. Mason himself told me when he first saw him as a, you know, when he was 2019, you know, Cameron Green was a 90 mile an hour man. He could bowl 145 kilometers an hour. And he kind of told Green, you know, just stick to 130, be happy bowling 135. Let's keep working your action. He's still a work in progress, by the way. But he's still, even in this test match, he's clocking 140 and he's got real pace. The height obviously must make a difference.
I think that's what got Pope in the first innings.
Exactly. I mean, he's not, you know, people are saying he's not doing much with the ball, but it's kind of like a fourth seamer who's still developing, and he's just, as long as he's being accurate, that's all you want. And also he was doing enough.
The ball he got root with,
yeah,
that's moved away a lot.
With the old ball as well, yeah. I guess it's quite a lazy comparison, but it kind of reminds me a bit of Shane Watson with the ball, especially with how economical he was. You kind of tossed the ball to Watson. I guess this is a period where Australia didn't have someone like Lyon in the spin department, and Watson had to do the holding role. And now you got Lyon, who bowled very well on day four, and you got Green as well, who you can almost just to go so under two and a half.
This is the hope for him in Australian cricket, right? If he can be that all-rounder that they've always craved and they've not had for a long time. Watson was, like you said, excellent at doing those sort of economical spells. But in the end, he kind of was, essentially, in Test cricket, he was basically about who bowled a few overs. By the end of his career, he was barely bowling, right? Green's interesting in that he could potentially be more, especially with those natural attributes. But he looks like he's already going to play a really key part in the series. I mean, we've still not seen... I mean, you've got a first baller with a bat, but he's quite sort of like a tall but quiet character who's kind of like kind of make quite a big impression in the series.
Yeah, I thought he was ominously good with the ball in this test. It's interesting about the Watson comparison. For me, it made me think of early Flintoff, when Flintoff was not by no means expressed when he first emerged, also had his injury difficulties, but you could see there was a really, really good bowler in there. And obviously Flintoff ended up bowling 90 miles an hour and being arguably England's best bowler for a period there. If Green can become that bowler, which it kind of looks like he could, that's it's kind of a terrifying thought. It also, sort of leaning on what Taha said as well, that having that four seamer is so useful, particularly if Stark's going to be a little bit erratic, a bit in and out. You can almost use Stark top and tail. You can use him with a newborn. You can use him to finish off the tail if Green is going to be reliable as that fourth seamer. So it didn't quite work for Australia in this test because Hazlewood obviously didn't bowl when England were, I mean, it's no coincidence, when England were on top for a bit in the context of that scenario, not the match as a whole. So they had to keep using Stark. But if Hazlewood was on the pitch there, I don't think Stark would have had to bowl that much in that session, in those two sessions, because Green could have done some of the heavy lifting, and then you've got Hazlewood, you've got Cummins, and you've got Lyon. Stark can almost just be kind of held back until he's at his most lethal. That said, I think there was enough waywardness in Stark to suggest that Jai Richardson will get a chance sooner rather than later. I don't know, probably not for Adelaide, but I wouldn't be surprised come the third test if Jai Richardson's playing rather than Stark.
Australia made over 400 in their response to England's 147. Warner scored 94. Labuschagne 70-odd. And Travis Head with the third fastest 100 in Ashes history that we've not talked about yet. Never in doubt, Joe.
Was it nothing to fear from Travis Head? I think I might have said.
But you did reference his good start in the Shield this year.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's generous. I think the point was, in context of the other Australian giants in that batting lineup, he shouldn't hold any fear for England. But obviously, he should have done, because he batted brilliantly. And he showed the value of seeing off the new ball and batting against a tiring attack late in the day. And that's not to take anything away from him. He played the role beautifully, perfectly. But that's exactly the role that you want to see Stokes or Pope or Butler be able to play if the top order have done some of the heavy lifting.
I just loved how ruthless he was. So when England bowled badly, he properly punished them. He was happy to strike it 120. The bowling was there to be hit. He hit it. He hit one incredible shot of wood where he kind of leant onto his front foot and just let the arms free and it smashed him through cover point.
And as soon as Stokes came to the attack, he just smashed him as well. Yeah. He sensed that Stokes was obviously not at his best, struggling with that knee injury. Head just looked so, right from the off, he looked really confident in a way that I haven't seen him bat with that kind of confidence. Obviously, he does in Aussie domestic cricket. He's got a fine record. So that's a bit of a shame that one of the... I suppose Marcus Harris didn't get any runs, did he? Yeah. So that's something.
Yeah, well, we talked about on last week's show that Khawaja might come in as an opener at some point in the series. And I think that the way Harris batted, even in the second innings, I think that may well happen. I think it's quite interesting. I've seen Head play in England in county cricket and not do that well. I've seen him play test cricket
really
in England.
Yeah, average 18.
Yeah. And he I've seen him play test cricket in England and he's not done that well. It was quite interesting. The Australian commentator was saying how he's playing his natural game when he's batting. I was like, I just didn't know that was a natural game because of how he's gone in England. And I guess it's from an Australian perspective to have a player who wants to bat like that feel free enough and comfortable enough to bat like that when there was literally pressure for his place going into the test match, I think, from an Australian point of view, is very encouraging. I thought Labuschagne looked brilliant. I thought he was so, so good. I mean, he threw it away, cutting a long hop from lead straight to point. But I thought it was as good as Root in terms of when he was batting, which didn't look like getting out. I think he's the one, not Smith, actually, I think he's going to punish England most this series.
He's the one with... You know, Smith was at the World Cup as well. He's the one also who's been in the Shield, you know, making runs there. And so he's kind of, yeah, he's kind of primed and ready. And it's interesting to reflect on 2 years ago where he sort of came in sort of out of nowhere and where he is now. Because now there's a kind of a presence to him as he kind of walks to the crease. It's like, oh, this guy's kind of like the real deal. Like he can rival Smith in terms of who's going to be like the leading run scorer. And I think he'll probably finish as the leading run scorer in the series. He looked in complete control. He was kind of, there were some really like tight leaves at the start of his innings where it's just like, how are you judging that? And obviously he's got his unique way about him. And so he's so relaxed with how he does it. And
yeah, just looked, yeah, like you said, he was just in complete control.
He batted beautifully. I really like watching Labuschagne. He's just a really entertaining character and cricketer. But obviously there's quite a bit of chat about him being captain at some stage. That surely can't happen, right? I mean, he is for a loan for DRS because he thinks everything yeah. is out. He couldn't possibly be captain. And I don't know, there was, actually, I think Phil might have mentioned in the last show that Greg Chappell said Labuschagne's like emotional character isn't well suited to being captain. And that certainly seems, that seems my impression. I mean, yeah. it'd be great entertainment, but I think Cummins seems like the right choice, to be honest.
Yeah, I think Labuschagne is, from an Australian's perspective, Labuschagne is just fine batting a three and averaging 67 or whatever he averages.
You'll take that.
Yeah. Joe, I thought England bowled really well for the first two sessions on day two. Wood and Robinson, I thought, were excellent. Wood, so unlucky not to get more wickets, beat Warner time and time again. You could see that his pace was causing Australia problems, got Smith out with a really nice ball. Yeah, the wheels came off. Stokes wasn't fully fit. Robinson was knackered. But Leach was targeted in a way that I think is a bit worrying for England. I thought it was different to when he got targeted in Chennai by Pant. But I guess with Stokes and Robinson, you kind of got the sense of what a lack of physical preparation does. They've not really had a day in the dirt for a long time. But on Robinson and Wood, that's an encouraging thing for England because no Anderson ball, a lot was made of that at the start of the test match, but they bowled really, really well.
Yeah, that they were really encouraging. I felt very sorry for them on the morning of day two. I thought, yeah, Robinson and Wood in particular were excellent. Chances put down, just poor luck. Robinson beat the bat on so many occasions. That is really encouraging. I think as a group, we had high hopes for Robinson in the series, and I think he's shown already that he's going to do well out there. I think he will have a really good series. Wood is always like you're kind of enjoying it, but thinking how long is it going to last? Is he really going to be able to play in a back-to-back test in Adelaide next week? And if he is, would he be in any state to play the third or the fourth or the fifth? That's always the thing you've got to manage with Mark Wood and work out how best to use him and what pitches are going to best suit his attributes, because they are unique in that England set up with no Archer there. He is far and away their fastest bowler. So to leave him out feels like a conservative move, but you've also got to work out when that pace is best utilised. It's a tricky balancing act they've got.
I thought Root managed him really well. He exclusively bowled, I think, just three over spells. And I thought, you know, that was very much a man who's learned his lesson of how to use a guy who bowls 90 plus miles per hour, given how he used Archer in 2019. I thought that was quite encouraging.
Maybe the fact that he's just bowled in one innings in this match, got a couple of days rest, that could be
That's very true, yeah.
Good foresight from the England batters then.
Yeah. That was a real silver lining.
Wood's not completely yeah, well,
we need to get Woody fit for the next test.
Before we move on, Lord Ian Botham is arguably one of the greatest cricketers that England has ever produced. The 1981 Ashes, Botham's Ashes, were undoubtedly his crowning glory. What is less known, though, is Ian's lifelong passion for wine and the art of creating it. 40 years as an international cricketer and commentator took Botham to wineries and vineyards across the globe. In the development of his own range of wines, he worked passionately with renowned winemakers to create bespoke blends to his exacting standards. Only when a wine is good enough to go on his own table does Ian allow his name to go on the label. Over the course of the Ashes, we are working in partnership with Botham Wines to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Botham's Ashes. Stock up for Christmas now at bothamwines.com, where you can also buy his 22 yards London dry gin and his gin-filled Christmas baubles. Thanks for your questions and your emails, as usual, especially those that came in between the hours of 2 and 3 in the morning. One of which is from Max, who sent us an email saying, I seem to be the only person with this perspective, at least from what I've read and heard so far, but I think England should be encouraged by the Gabba test despite the result. He said Hamid looked good, Australia had the rub of the green, etc. Tar, what do you reckon?
Yeah, that's quite optimistic. Oh, I do want to finish my Butler point.
Yes.
Because that was an optimistic point.
Yeah.
In that, like I was saying, he has talked about playing the situation, but coming into this tournament, coming to the series, he talks about wanting to play with a bit of freedom. He's coming off the T20 World Cup. We kind of saw that in those two innings. And when he did get out yesterday, it was kind of
it kind of went against everything he'd been doing leading up to that point, where he just wasn't decisive. He was kind of, well, should I play it, should I not? Which obviously happens against these bowlers. The key is, and it's the big if, is can the guys coming in before him give him the room to you know, play those innings and make them into big scores, which is basically, you know, yesterday could have made a big difference if England had got to that new ball, Root and Milan had got to that new ball, kind of managed to negate it for just, you know, 10 overs or something like that, and just given Butler the space to come in and do what he is very much capable of doing. And it seems like he's kind of like in the right sort of mental space to get runs in the series. And so I think he is a positive. I think I quite like the look of the way he was sort of just going about his game, his kind of approach, and it kind of suggests to me that, like, there is something there to work with, and that he can really actually have quite decent series.
Mm.
So there's another little layer of optimism there.
That's good. Tom asks, how could England juggle the batting depth, assuming Broad and or Anderson play the next test? Can they bat Robinson 8, or do they need Wokes to be at 8? If Wokes bats at 8, who misses out between Robinson and Wood? A bit left field, but could they play Overton at 8 and Robinson at 9 to bolster the batting? I guess, moving on to the next test match, from an England point of view, we expect the top 7 to be the top 7 from the batting point of view. So, Joe, answering Tom's question there, how do you get 4 quicks, assuming Leach doesn't play the next test match, into an 11?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of an unsolvable puzzle, unfortunately, when it comes to batting depth. Well, so I would, to go through the team, obviously I would have the same top 7. I would drop Leach for Anderson, and then I would want to get Broad in. So I'd check on the fitness of Mark Wood. If he's fit and raring to go, then he plays. And then I suppose it's Broad in for Wokes. Wokes was the weakest of England seamers in this test, but bar Stokes, so they're kind of frontline seamers. But then you have got Robinson at 8, who hasn't got a run since he had quite a promising debut with the bat. And that is an issue. And Warren picked out some stats on commentary of what Australia's bottom 4 have provided compared to England's. And it's a huge... There are several kind of chasms between the team, but that is an enormous one. And England desperately need those runs. And I'm not quite sure how they do it. The other thing, Wokes at 8 is not the same as having Wokes at 8 in England. He obviously struggles against the short ball. I know he got a few in this test, but I don't really see him getting big scores in the way that I might back him to in England. So it's potentially, is it worth picking Wokes because his batting is superior, when actually we don't necessarily think he's going to score that many runs in Australia anyway? Do you just say, all right, we'll go with our best 4 bowlers for the conditions and hope that's enough to win us a test? That is probably what I would do for Adelaide. So I'd go Broad, Anderson, Robinson, Wood, and just accept that we're not going to score many runs from the last 4 wickets, which we haven't been doing anyway. But it's not—it's certainly not ideal.
Tar, what do you reckon? Tar, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think Joe's right, basically.
I completely get that. But Robinson has batted so badly since his first test match. That is as weak an 8, 9, 10, 11. I can remember, I think England had one pretty bad one for one of the New Zealand home tests.
So we say Wokes has to play at 8 because we need his batting, then which seamer does misses out?
Probably Broad.
There is also an issue, I think. I think all of us were surprised that neither Broad or Anderson played. And now if you play both of them, you're playing 2 bowlers who are obviously getting on a bit, haven't got many overs in their legs. Broad hasn't played for a long time. It's quite a risk having both of them in the same attack, I think. And this is always the advantage of having one, and the advantage we would have had of playing one at Brisbane, in that you get a bit of overs in everyone's legs and hopefully everyone gets up to speed. Whereas now it feels quite a risk to have half your attack, Broad and Anderson, who are coming in cold. And
you can't really rely on Stokes, fitness-wise.
This is one, I think we've been critical of Silverwood and Root's selections and certainly the treatment of Jack Leach, but I do have sympathy with the balancing of the seamers and the lack of runs that the tail are providing. I just don't think there is really a neat solution that fits the bill.
Yeah, I think with Anderson coming back in, I'd keep Wokes, just because I don't think there's that much of a difference between Wokes and Broad bowling wise, and the batting's obviously there is enough of a difference there to for me to go for Wokes. I also think Wokes bowled pretty well. He didn't start great, but he bowled pretty well. And I think if you're comparing England 2021-22 to 17-18, yeah, England batted worse in this test match than they did at Brisbane in 2017-18, but I think they bowled quite a lot better. I think Robinson and Wood were like, genuinely very, very good. I think you've got to keep them in. Wokes bowled pretty well. To be honest, not worse than how Broad's gone on some Ashes tours in the past. So I think I'd stick with Wokes.
I can completely understand that, and I would be pretty happy with that selection as well, to be honest. But that does, you do have a potential scenario there where England are 2-0 down in the Ashes after two tests and Stuart Broad hasn't got a game. And people are rightly going to say, why haven't you played Stuart Broad?
Stuart Broad might be one of them. yeah. One thing we should have mentioned earlier is Nathan Lyon getting to 400 test wickets and how well he bowled on day four. There's a great stat from CricViz analyst Ben Jones. So in test matches in Australia, Nathan Lyon has 204 wickets at 33. In those test matches, other spinners have taken 180 wickets at 63, which is incredible. So he's basically got an average of about half of other spinners. And I know he didn't go great against India last winter, but when he's on song, he's a brilliant, brilliant bowler to watch. And there was glimpses of that on day four, especially when he's got a silly point in, when he got David Milan right, after the commentators going on and on about that. That was a good win for Mark Waugh and Shane Warne.
Yeah, that was quite amusing. The thing I've always loved about Nathan Lyon, and which is probably one of the reasons why he is so successful in those conditions, is that he just gives that ball a lot of revs. Like, he has always had that ability. When he first came to the side, he didn't have the nuances, really. He was still trying to figure out what worked for him in test match cricket in terms of coming over the wicket, around the wicket. Tactically, he was still developing. He hadn't played a lot of first class cricket before he started playing test cricket. And I think the first time I ever saw him, he played in the sort of the BBL at the time. It wasn't, you know, whatever it was called. And what he had then as well is that he had flight and he ripped the ball. And so I was watching him in T20 cricket, but you could tell, there's a red ball bowler there as well. And he's always had that, and he's kind of, and he's just developed, and he's had stages where he's kind of like ticked a box, basically. And, you know, he ticked a box 7 years ago when he sort of bowled Australia to victory in India. And he's kind of, it's incredible to see that he's come and taken 400 test wickets now. That's an extraordinary achievement. So few bowlers have done that.
Well, only Warne and McGraw have more for Australia.
Oh, right. Exactly. And so there's always that enjoyment with him, in that he has that natural rip. He gets, you know, what makes him so successful in Australia as well, is that he can kind of get that extra bounce from the from the overspin he has. But yeah, incredible achievement. And he was always gonna, that wait for the 400th was just going on and on and on. But you kind of sense that, you know, once he kind of got his rhythm, got it all together, he was going to have a say, and he's going to have have a say in the series, isn't he? Yeah.
Mm.
I think he's been around for so long, it's almost, it's kind of hard to remember when he wasn't playing for Australia, but it's easy to forget that for four or five years, Australia didn't have a spinner worthy of the name. They tried all sorts, none of which went particularly well, or some went briefly well, and then...
Michael Beer, Xavier Doherty.
Yeah, and it's no coincidence, the only time England have won in Australia that I can remember in my lifetime, just about... Australia didn't have a spinner, basically. I mean, sometimes they didn't play a spinner. When they played Doherty, he just got smashed by Peterson at Adelaide. Beer went for loads of runs as well. So that really shows, I mean, obviously 400 wickets shows it pretty well, but it shows what Australia were missing when they didn't have a spinner of Lyon's quality. And also it just emphasises the gap in England's spin department as well, in that Leach is not really equipped to do the role that Lyon does in terms of either taking wickets or holding down an end, and Lyon can do both. Some of that is not necessarily Leach's fault, in that he hasn't been given enough chances and been able to feel settled in the side, but you just look at Lyon and the way he balances that attack, and it's hard not to feel very envious.
Yeah,
there's just a contrast in the way you look at selection as well, and that shows you a class of a spinner. Jack Leach's sort of value is sort of so weirdly linked to Ben Stokes's value. If Ben Stokes isn't there, it's like, oh, now we can play Leach. With Lyon, it doesn't matter whether you have an all-rounder or not. Now they do have Cameron Green, but before that it was like, well, he's gonna be fine.
Yes,
we don't have to think about insurance. We can just go in with Nathan Lyon. That's what makes that speaks to his excellence, really.
Kind of like England with Swan, right? England, yeah, exactly. It's the only time this century really England haven't really been bothered about playing an all-rounder or having
Colin,
four quicks.
Collingwood was the fifth bowler, yeah, exactly, for a long period, exactly, of time.
And also with Lyon, some of the criticism he's got over the last year or so, he still doesn't go for many. It's not as if the opposition can really attack. I know Pant did that a little bit last winter, but in the first innings when he didn't bowl, on day three when he didn't bowl that well, it wasn't as if England were really going after him. Yeah, he's got remarkable control. To finish the show, English listeners, if you're wondering, I wonder how the England Lions are doing, I've got some bad news for you.
We're going to finish with a pick-me-up.
So Australia A batted first. They were bowled out for 213, which is good going from England. Liam Norwell took a 5 for 58. Don Best took 4 for 80. Wasn't a great 4 for, not going to lie. A couple of long hops in there. And then England were blown away for 103. Michael Nisa took 5 for 29. None of England's top five passed 10. Josh Bannon, top scorer, 22. Then Australia piled on 349 for 4, declared. Nick Mandelson hit 71 off 46. Bryce Street scored 100.
What were Bess's figures in that innings?
2 for 157 off 37 overs. And Mitchell Marsh scored 60 off 27, including 7 sixes. And England go better in the second innings. They're 136 for 3. James Brace is currently 57 not out.
Get him in.
Get him in. He's got. I think that's the closer play after day three. I think so. England have got 300 to win on the last day. Go on, James Bracey. That's all the time we have today. Cheers, R. Cheers, Joe. Cheers for coming in on Saturday. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast in association with Charles Tirrett. Remember to use the code Wisden20 at checkout. We'll be back next week. If you enjoy the show, tell your friends. And yeah, we'll see you after the second test match.
Sports Social Podcast Network.